The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good afternoon. Okay, my own headphones are kind of loud.
Yeah, I'm a little loud.
We're all loud. Who's in here before? Deaf people?
Yeah.
What? You're supposed to say what? welcome to We the People. Another unceremonious beginning. We like our unceremonious beginnings. Actually, it's a good thing we like them because...
That's all we have.
It's our best material.
That's our hat trick.
It is. Oh, my gosh. Well, we have a really fun show today. And... We're not talking politics today, actually, because little does everyone know, actually a lot of people do know, but little does the general public know, yesterday was really Memorial Day.
Yep.
And so we planned this Memorial Day program with Ken Delfino a long time ago, and we put it on the weekend of Memorial Day, not realizing at the time
the real
that,
Memorial Day.
That the hot dog festival, the three-day hot dog festival was last week, so... This day we're celebrating Memorial Day, the real one. So we're talking about, oh my gosh, he's got a map. He's got a map and a book.
Oh, we're going on a journey.
Yeah, it's too bad. So if you hear like crinkling, we have a lot of paper in here. Apparently there's a map involved. This isn't good.
Where's the camera?
And it's of France, you know, so we're going to have a lot of tricky sounding names that Bill and I won't be pronouncing because obviously we don't know French. Need to get that Steve Martin clip on there, you know, the one, you know, he spoke French. He's going to die. So let's see. Let's tell you about Ken. He lives in Colfax. He's lived there since December 2001. He's a medically retired Navy veteran, 1964 to 1969. He served with the Amphibious Squadron 5. Okay, Ken, you've got to fill me in on this. There's all sorts of secret in the USS Seminole.
That was our ship.
Yeah, it was your ship.
It was our ship. It was a cargo attack, amphibious cargo ship.
Nice. You were a boat captain, river patrol force in the Mekong Delta, South Vietnam, from 1966 to 68. So I'm sure, you know, that wasn't exciting at all.
Those were during my communist downsizing days.
communist downsizing.
Maybe there's a little politics to be had here. And then you worked for United Airlines from 1969 to 2002. What'd you do with United anyway?
Other than getting yelled at a lot, my job was sales. I enjoyed the job. I worked in San Francisco in our Fisherman's Wharf office for 25 of my 32 years, and we transferred. We have a branch office in Suisun City, so my commute dropped from 49 miles to a mile and a half.
Nice.
It was pretty nice.
You commuted from Suisun to San Francisco like every...
Every 4 days. Well, I was on a 10-hour shift.
Brutal. Yucky. Let's see. Okay, I'm going to learn some things about Ken that I didn't know. He enjoys golf. I didn't know that. Is that true? Or are you lying?
Well, the relative enjoyment is irrelevant to the talent.
Okay.
So, I think that's the case in most people that pick up golf clubs.
Yeah, because it says here skill is not relative to enjoyment. And right. I'm like, is there a trick to this? Average 49er and hockey ice fan. Owns a trophy business. I did not know that. KMD Trophies and Awards. Really?
Yes.
Geez, that's handy. And his wife is Melba, and Melba's a past president of Kiwanis?
Yes, yes.
I am a past president of Kiwanis.
I'm a past member.
Bill, what have you done lately?
Yeah, well, I was a member of Kiwanis.
That's right, I used to rope you into that. That's pretty fun. Ken volunteers with the Placer County Sheriff's Department, and is involved with Junior Falcons football, and City Council. Forgot about that. 2008 to 2012, you were the mayor. You were the mayor, I think, when I met you.
In 2010. 11, yes. 10, 11. 10, 11. Or 11, 12. Yeah, 10, 11.
And now you're let's see, reelected in 2014 to 2018.
I have nothing else to do.
I don't believe that.
Retire and then work twice as hard. Well, good for you. Well, thank you for your service, and thank you for representing our veterans, and especially on this whole Normandy and D-Day information. You guys have a great program. We have listed it for you guys out on the radio. We have listed it on the website, wethepeopleradio.us. Today is a day whether you do it right this minute or you do it later on. But this is a time when you definitely want to check out the website. There is an amazing video. We'll be playing the music. When you hear kind of a, oh, it's probably 5 or 6 minutes, it's a really nice, what is it called again, Ken?
John Williams' piece. It's Hymn for the Fallen.
Hymn for the Fallen. I always want to say Tribute to the Fallen. Hymn for the Fallen, and it's really, really beautiful. And then there are quite a few pictures on the website of Ken's travels over there and the program that he is involved in. That is called, if my website would come up quickly, what do you guys call it?
Honor Their Memory.
Honor Their Memory. And you invented that. I think I called you the originator, but bottom line is you invented it back in 1995.
Well, how that happened is...
Yeah, I was going to say, tell us why.
I first became aware of the American Battle Monument Commission's function in June of 93 when I visited Paris, France for my first time. And across the Seine River is a town of Suresnes, which is more advanced, it's more modern than Paris is. But at the top of Mont Valérien, in that town, is a World War I American military cemetery. 1,500 men are buried there, and some names of some missing. I got my first experience with one of those cemeteries. And I'd always, when I was in high school, I loved history, and I knew about Normandy. I'd always wanted to visit one of those, but at that time in my life, I was really kind of an isolationist. You know, nobody liked us, so I didn't like anybody else.
Well, you got such reception when you came back, so I can't imagine how that would have...
Well, in this particular case, my Kiwanis responsibilities required that I attend a convention in Nice, France. So our visit was to Suresnes, and I was impressed. This was on June 30th of 93. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I was impressed at how clean the cemetery grounds were, how clean the markers were. There were hardly any leaves on the ground. You know, just, the lawn was just beautifully green. The blacks... the fencing and the gilt on the top of the fence, just absolutely sparkling. And these superintendents, they take great care in what they do. We have, I think, 26 cemeteries in countries Western Europe, Italy, North Africa, and the Philippines that they are responsible for, as well as 26 or 27 individual markers that are some are put up by the host country and others are put up by the government. So I... in 1994, I was asked by our Kiwanis governor, Ted Gibbs, to serve as his international relations chairman. So I was trying to figure out what to do. I had no project in mind on an international race, but we were coming up on the 50th anniversary of D-Day. I came home one night, and I turned on the TV, and all I saw was a white screen and no sound. So I couldn't figure out what's the matter with the television. So you turn on your little clicker,
sure,
and the volume keeps going, the bar goes keep going right and right, and there's still no sound other than hum. So what's the matter? I changed channels, and I found out there was nothing wrong with the volume. So I went back, and then about that time, all of a sudden, the camera moved back from what was a close-up of a white marker.
Then it
moved back, and you start seeing the green grass, then the red, white, and blue of the French and U.S. flags, and then... It was on a cherry picker, and as it came up, then you start to see the beginning of over 9,300 graves, and Tom Brokaw was doing his live broadcast from Normandy on the 50th anniversary of D-Day, and that got me.
Mm. Yeah,
that really got me. Yeah, and so I was impressed. I listened. I watched the whole ceremony. It was done very well, and so that my goal was to, for the next year, to get all the Kiwanis clubs in our district. I think about 600 Kiwanis clubs at the time in our district. Get every Kiwanis club to donate those graveside flags to decorate the graves on the 50th anniversary of the end of World War II in Europe. That was my original goal. I wasn't getting a really fast reaction to that, and I'm kind of impatient at times. But another idea came up that we could donate flags to the cemeteries, and that we did. We got our Kiwanis Club started donating flags to the cemeteries that they could use in their place, and that went real well. And I made my first visit to one of the cemeteries in Ardennes in September of 1994, where I met Hans Hooker, who was the superintendent there, and he showed us around, which was really great, and then Normandy the next day.
Now, are these cemeteries, I watched the video, and just be forewarned, if you watch that video, keep a hanky close by.
It's a Kleenex video.
Yeah, it's definitely a Kleenex video. But are the graves at those sites all American graves?
Yes.
Yeah. That's what I thought.
The cemeteries are maintained by an American superintendent who has either usually a counterpart of the host nation. They work side by side, and then all the groundskeepers are of the host nation. And then there's other staff. Normandy has, I think, the largest staff. The last time I was there last year, I noticed a very large staff that they had that I had not seen before. The very first time I went there, there was my good friend Lee Atkinson was the assistant. I think that was the second day on the job, which was kind of neat. And then Phil Rivers was the superintendent. And then they had two ladies there who are, I think, still there working. And then George, the groundskeeper. So it was a very small staff in 94 at my first visit. Now it's like quadruple the size of staff.
Do you have... I watched the video. Do you have the numbers, just to give people an idea how big these cemeteries are, the numbers of soldiers that are buried?
I don't have the exact numbers, but the largest one is the in Europe is the Meuse-Argonne, which I believe has over 14,000 men buried there, and that's in the Argonne Forest. It's a World War I cemetery. As a matter of fact, there's a road that goes right through the middle of the cemetery to another town. That's there, which is right next door. The largest World War II cemetery over there is the one at Lorraine, which is in the eastern part, in the town outside the town of Metz, which is the eastern part of France. It's on off the major highway between Paris and Germany. And then the largest one with number of bodies is in the Philippines. I believe they have around 17,000. But the most impressive is they have over 35,000 names on the wall of the missing, and these are from all the sailors, mostly sailors and aviators that we lost during World War II and all the sea battles.
Right, that weren't recovered.
Right.
Yeah. It when you watch the video, they give. I mean, it's great photography of the cemeteries. It gives you the name of the cemetery and the number buried there. And as it rolls through, it's unbelievable. The condition of the cemeteries, which you were talking about earlier,
perfect.
Every blade of grass, and it amazes me that to this day they take such pride in caring for those grounds.
When I first met Lee, he told me once. He said, second time or third time I went there, said any time you hear a superintendent say my cemetery is looking pretty good, it's time for them to leave, because those guys are never satisfied with
it. Shows.
I mean, they really they want to know what took place in every inch of the ground of the cemetery. And I'll relate a story in point. Lee was walking us around at Normandy, and he's telling a story about he was getting ready to close, and with the World War II vets come up, they take total precedence over anybody else that's there.
Stop the presses.
These guys have precedence,
sure,
and they're given the royal treatment. But he's walking with this one guy. He said, "I can get a golf cart. You want to take the golf cart?" And he said, "Oh, no." He said, "I walk back then. I'll walk there now." You know. So he goes back, yeah, and they're walking along the seawall, and he stopped. And he says, "That's where I came, right up that draw." And Lee says, "Well, I was, being real proud of that he knows his cemetery grounds. Except for Captain Joe Dawson's engineers came up there." The guy looked at him. Lee said, the guy looked at me like I knew that. I was right behind him. So he gets a lot of these reactions.
They actually know what happened on the ground because they were actually there.
Right.
All right, we need to take a quick break. You are listening to We the People. I know, Ken's like, already? I told you, I warned you, it's going to go fast. Find us online, wethepeopleradio.us. There's a ton of information. And we have some special sponsors for today's show. We're going to be putting them in and got some great information for you. Stay tuned with us. What shall we do about them? When they move into your neighborhood, they take over but good. They want you all body and soul. Then it's just your body.
You're listening to We the People on Community Talk Radio for the North State, AM 1460, KCNR.
This is Brian Cunat calling from beautiful Napa County, where the Matera Cunat Family Vineyards is producing some excellent wines. I am proud to be part of the show today and represent Ken Delfino, We actually named our brand new tasting room after Ken Delfino for his patriotic service to our country, his caring for the others that have served before him. We actually have specials all the time for any vets that would like to come and visit our tasting room at Big Ranch Road and Oak Knoll Avenue in beautiful downtown Napa. So we look forward to seeing you, and congratulations, Ken. We think the world of you.
Thank you, Brian. That is awesome. Ken's mouth is hanging open. Oh, did we lose him?
Well, I decided to give him an extra minute or two to talk. He's a big talker, so we'll let him go. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian. Matera Vineyards, good for you guys. Support our veterans. Support our Ken Delfino. He's famous. And for those of you that are listening live here, don't forget you can always call us 530-605-4567 here at KCNR. Thanks, Matera, for doing that segment of the program. Bob, do we have another ad to run, or do we run our music? This is new. We've not done these commercials. This is like old-time radio. You know, we need, like, we don't have any soap people. If we had some soap people, that would be better, you know?
Yeah, we need
scrub it up
of,
with so-and-so.
A banjo and a harmonica. And
so we have
yeah.
We have the namesake of the tasting room at Matera Vineyard. That's pretty good, though.
Yeah.
For all you wine drinkers out there. We're back. You're joining We the People. Keep up with us online at wethepeopleradio.us. We've got video. We've got photos. We have a wonderful photo array there that Ken Delfino provided for us today. We're talking about Normandy and the project Honor Their Memory. Okay, Ken, quit writing. Swivel the microphone back around. We're on. We're on, bud.
Okay.
Okay. So, what's our next story, or our next stop, I guess, along the journey?
Well, actually, there's a couple of things about Normandy. They have 33 sets of brothers buried there.
Oh, wow.
Two of the most notable brothers you've heard of them in one way or another. The Nylands, Lieutenant Preston and Sergeant Robert Nyland, are buried side by side, and these were the two of the brothers that were portrayed in the movie Saving Private Ryan. There was a third brother who was captured in the South Pacific. He was on a B-25 crew, and then they were looking for the fourth one, Fritz, who based on what I've read about him, I don't know if he was at that battle in the last scene in Saving Private Ryan. But it was a good story, but it's based on a true story. Colonel Ollie Reed was killed on July 30th of 1944 in the Brittany area of Normandy. And his son, First Lieutenant Ollie Reed Jr., was killed in Italy on July 4th of 1944.
Wow.
They're both buried side by side, and I had heard that the wife had received telegrams on the same day, which had to be pretty heartbreaking. On the Wall of the Missing, there are over 1,500 names on the Wall of the Missing. There's 22 of them. Are the names of men from Bedford, Virginia. They died on 33 or 34 hit the beaches on Normandy. They were from the small town, a farming community, 3,000 people. And they hit the beaches. 19 of them were killed on the beach. Three more were killed later during the campaign. And because Bedford had the highest per capita casualty rate of any city in the United States, that is why the D-Day Memorial, the National D-Day Memorial, is there, and it's magnificent. I believe you posted a link on there, and
yes,
they can always use donations to help keep operating. That project was started by Sergeant Bob Slaughter, who was also with the 29th Infantry Division, wanted to do something in memory of the men from Virginia. Another, on a side note, 29th, another man locally, Redding, who was with the 29th Infantry, was Leo Simon. And I was given the honor of having a flag flown over the Normandy Cemetery for him several years ago. This was done in conjunction with Special Forces Chapter 89 here in Reading. And so we honored him with a flag that had flown over his buddy's graves, as well as some sand from Omaha Beach. Another big significance, and my grandson picked this up when we were there last summer, he came up to me and he says, "How come there's so many men with the number 66th Division on there?" Well, these were soldiers of the 63 regiments of the 66th Infantry Division. They were on the SS Leopoldville, which is a Belgian ship, and they were being shuttled from England to Cherbourg because they were going to be released for the Battle of the Bulge, and they were torpedoed 5 miles from shore. And because they're all geared down with heavy coats and all their equipment and stuff, most of them drowned. And so they lost over 700 men from that division on that ship.
That would explain.
Yeah, the names on 66. But I was really pleased that he noticed that he really took particular notice of that.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. You might just walk through there and not even see it.
Right.
So how many, when you go over there, you've been there how many times?
For several years. And I'm not a, just let the public know, I'm not a rich person. I happen to work for United Airlines. I have pass benefits, which really made it really, and being a Kiwanian, that all tied in together. So I was able to get on passes, and get on flights over there. Normandy's only a three-hour drive when you get to the Orne River. Near the city of the town of Caen, I forget which one's which. It's C-A-E-N. It's about 3 hours to there, and then another half an hour, 45 minutes to the actual areas that we liberated. When you get to the Orne River, make a right turn and head towards the ocean or the channel, you'll come to the town, the small village of Benneville. Benneville was a target of the British Airborne 6th Airborne Division, and their job was to hold two of those bridges because there were German Panzer units to the north that had to be kept out to keep the landing beaches free, and their orders were to hold until relieved. Well, your folks will see on a website the bridge and the memorial there that the French have put there with all the flags of all the Allies, and there are some markers there, and that's where these gliders landed at 12:15 in the morning. Now, on a glider, you don't have a go-around. It's one shot in your
area,
right?
Yeah, you land or else.
The first one landed about 30 yards from the bridge.
Okay.
The second one landed behind them, and the third one landed between the two. And there was only one one killed in action. That was Lieutenant Den Brothridge, who was killed in the battle on the bridge itself. They captured, they caught the Germans totally by surprise. Then they captured the Gondre Café liberated the first building liberated, first family, the Gondre family, and the daughter, who was like 2 or 3 years old at the time, Arlette, she runs the café now. At this time, it's the unofficial headquarters of the British 6th Airborne Division.
No kidding.
Yep. You'll see them every once in a while. They're maroon berets and stuff. Really kind of neat.
So when you're back there, how many do you run into a lot of Americans at these locations?
Yes, there's a lot of tour buses, but I've thanks to Lee and some of these other superintendents, I've been to these different areas. They pointed out places to us where the tour buses don't go.
Nice.
And so that's really kind of neat. I'll get to some of those places later on. On your way from the Normandy Cemetery towards the town of St. Mary Glees, which our paratroopers liberated, is about 2 miles away, is a German cemetery. It's in the little village of Lacombe, and there are 22,220 some odd Germans buried there. And a lot of Germans, from what I heard, were buried there because they could not be repatriated back to the East Germany. The Russians didn't want them in East Germany. So they said, "No, you keep them. We don't want them." Then over the years, several years ago, German students have come over. They take care of the graves during the summer. And they also have planted a tree for every German soldier buried there. So it's a beautiful setting that you can see. And you see the contrast between the Allied graves and the German graves. Ours are all white, either markers or crosses and Stars of David. And when you look at the German cemetery there, it's very bleak for some reason, dark and bleak. Fortunately for us, for our troops, Captain Michael Wittmann is buried there. He was a German tank commander who was a very good tank commander. He was battle-hardened. He had fought in the Eastern Front against the Russians, extremely successful, and he was killed on August. He was back there, and, of course, none of the Germans moved without Hitler's orders because he didn't want to be wakened because this whole thing was going on, right? Fortunately for us, because I think if Wittmann had turned all his tanks loose, there might have been some serious problems. And also, I don't know how the British would have done against the Germans from the other direction, but we had no tanks to fight back at that time until later on in the day.
Oh, so we kind of lucked out.
Yeah, we did.
Good thing the guy had everybody scared.
And the other thing, too, about the leadership that day, a lot of officers were killed on the first waves.
Right.
He had got it down to sergeants, corporals who were taking command and just starting to do things because things needed to be done.
Sure.
And a lot of times when I'm talking to students, to athletes and stuff like that, I tell them, look, somebody's got to take charge. It doesn't look like anybody's taking charge on a court or on a field. You take charge. Somebody's got to lead and others will follow. And that's what happened in Normandy.
Interesting. Yeah, you don't think about that.
Yeah.
That's true. They'd wind up leaderless and they couldn't just all sit there and wait for somebody to come boss them around.
A lot of heroism that day.
Oh, boy. Somebody had to jump up and go first. And
right.
Bodies falling all around you. That's an incredible scene. If you've never seen the movie, it's frightening.
Well, the other thing, too, is it's a tremendous sign of their training.
Yes.
That they were able to do that, because then you don't have a lot of time to sit around and figure out, you know, there's not a lot of planning that goes on. You just start moving.
Right.
I'm just so impressed, always have been impressed. Every time you see pictures, I've never been to these sites. So impressed at how they take care of our fallen.
Yes.
Because they're so grateful for the service that they gave. And I think sometimes we forget that.
Well, it's not just our people who take care of them. It's a lot of the locals.
That's what I mean.
Oh, yeah.
I mean. In this particular case, you know, the French are incredibly respectful. And in many of these places, you had made notes that the American flag flies there, not just at the cemetery, but in other places in the towns every day.
Right. Exactly. It's really kind of neat. There is one cemetery there from the very beginning, the one in the Netherlands, in the town of Margraten, a little town of 400 people. But we have 8,300 graves there. The last one being placed there in 1994. I think the second lieutenant Utrecht was found by a Dutch farmer who was taking down some trees because he wanted to expand his field, and he found a soldier buried there. He had his dog tags, and so they buried him there at Margraten. But there's two nurses there. There's a General Maurice Rose is there. He was the one whose tanks. One of the tank divisions that helped free the battle, loosen up the Battle of the Bulge. He went into Bastogne. There's also, at Margraten, every single grave has been adopted by a Dutch family as their own son or daughter. And they come out and decorate on the birthday, on the anniversary of the death, wow. Memorial Day, Veterans Day, Armistice Day to them. And the rule is that only one family can have a grave. And they're going now into their third generation. No one's given up their soldier.
Oh, no kidding.
I was going to ask that question, Ken. This happened, over 70 years ago. Obviously, we're looking at probably at least second or third generation of folks that are taking care of these. And there's still that sense of...
That's part of their family.
Yes.
Almost heritage that they will continue to carry on their duty.
Well, it's passed on. The parents and grandparents make darn sure that their kids and grandkids know what sacrifice was made there, both on this on the Allied parts and also on their own families.
Wow.
There was one passage I want to read from this one book. Where to put the book? There's a book out called My Longest Night by a French lady, Geneviève Dubuc.
Oh, I'm reading that right now.
I first met her on my first trip to Normandy when Lee and I turned. He invited me to retreat the colors that day. He said, "You're in luck. Geneviève is here today." And so I saw at the base of one of the flagpoles a lady in a white dress suit standing very, very at attention. Got closer. She's wearing what looks like a hairpin dust, but it's lavender. It's kind of maroon, mm-hmm. and it's the Legion of Honor. She'd been awarded the Legion of Honor by the French. She was 10, 11 years old when our troops landed on D-Day. We had seven or eight paratroopers landed on her farm. So they hit them. They housed them and hit them, fed them for until they had the breakout.
And these were wounded soldiers
wounded and lost. Yeah,
right.
Then eventually they took in some Germans also. So you had American and German at the same ranch.
Yeah.
And there was just an unspoken rule.
It was like the free zone. It was like Switzerland.
Yeah.
Their own private Switzerland.
But there was one phrase in here on July 11th. Her mom said, there's something you have to see. She has to see. So she goes outside, and she looks over, and she says, without a word, Papa handed me the binoculars and led me outside where he pointed in the direction of Amfreville, which is one of the villages down there we visited. So all of a sudden I realized we were outside the house, standing right on the tracks in direct line with the chateau, and not a trace of a bullet. Silence. I adjusted the binoculars ever so slightly, and then I saw, oh, what I saw, the American flag flapping in the breeze, flying proudly over the chateau. It looked so beautiful. All those stars and stripes that I recognized right away. One day in class, Mademoiselle Bourneuf had drawn it in for us on a blackboard using only colored chalk available. He then had us draw it for ourselves at our desks. Never heard we worked so hard to draw a flag. We wanted to get every detail absolutely right, for it was, we know, the symbol of freedom.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, you're going to make us cry.
Well, it was...
That is awesome.
The one part early in the book when she talks about how much they were looking forward to the day when they were going to get their freedom back.
Right.
And they were waiting for the Allies to come. And they waited and waited, and they were so poor, and they just knew they were coming. And when they came, they go into the feelings and the joy and the heartache. And I mean, it's an incredible story. But
kind of flies in the face of what we're hearing these days,
mm-hmm.
you know, that we're the bad guys and that we just ran around the world making a mess.
But
thanks so much for that idea.
You go in those villagers, they say, forget what they say in the cities.
Yep.
It's just like rural America.
Sure.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, where the regular people live.
Right.
So out here where the regular people live, we need to take a quick break. You are listening to We the People Radio. Stick with us and join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. And if you have friends and family who have missed this program, the archive will be up this afternoon.
Well, if you ask me where I come from, here's what I tell everyone. I was born by God's dear grace in an extraordinary place, where the stars and stripes and the eagle fly.
You're listening to We the People on AM 1460 KCNR.
Here comes Pete. He flipped my microphone just in time. Pete Horton from Kiwanis Kalaniva Foundation. Hi, Pete.
Hi, Aaron. Pediatric trauma or unintentional injury is the number one killer of children age 14 and under in America. Each year, 9,000 families in the U.S. lose a child because of an injury. And sadly, studies indicate 90% of these injuries can be prevented. For this reason, the Kiwanis Kalaniva Foundation and the Kiwanis Clubs of California, Nevada, and Hawaii adopted pediatric trauma as their major focus. To learn how to protect our kids, please visit www.cnhfoundation.org.
Thanks, Pete. We totally support the mission of Kiwanis, and that's what has brought us our guest today.
Great. Thanks, Aaron.
Thank you very much. If you guys want to, if anybody has anything to add or call in today, the number is 530-605-4567. You're listening to We the People.
I hear people talking bad about the way they have to live here in this country. Harping on the wars we fight, griping about the way things ought to be. I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down our country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. They're walking on the fighting side of me. let this song that I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down a country horse, you walk in on the fighting side of me.
Welcome back to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We are here with all-around good guy, amazing Vietnam veteran, Kiwanis past president, and founder of the
Honor Their Memory.
Honor Their Memory. A great program. We're talking about Normandy today.
Yeah, yeah. Ken, you
and
were talking about...
celebrating Real Memorial Day.
Yeah. You were talking about the book My Longest Night, and...
Yes.
The main character and author of that, Genevieve, was 11 years old when the paratroopers came in on D-Day. It was the night before they actually landed, wasn't it?
The paratroopers came in like at 3 or 4 in the morning. Ours did around 2 or 3 in the morning. The British landed first at the other end. But they were so scattered all over.
Right, and then they landed in fields that the Germans had flooded.
Right, exactly.
And a lot of them landed in shallow water, but a lot of them landed in water that was over six feet deep and loaded down with all the gear. They didn't have a chance, and they drowned on the spot.
Exactly.
And her family, or her dad in particular, rode out and started collecting these guys. And at 11 years old, she had the presence of mind to throw a bunch of wood in her fire, because it was pitch black, and she threw a bunch of wood in her fireplace and basically got a chimney fire going where these guys could see the light from that fire.
And nowhere to go
to get on shallow ground and get out of the water. And at 11 years old, how many kids today would have that presence of mind? It was amazing.
Well, one of the characters that I met in the village of St. Mary Glees, I think it was on my second trip that Redding's John Kleckner, a lot of people know him here in the veteran community. He asked me on behalf of his group, which was vets at the time, to deliver 5 flags to the city of St. Mary Glees. Our flag flies here in 4 places every day in town, then once out at the Lafayette Bridge. I'll cover that bridge in a second. So I brought them, but I let we had met previous on a previous trip. We had met Phil Jutra, who was a who came into the village on the 14th of June. He was a warrant officer. His job was to send out replacement troops and equipment to where they needed to go. Phil's a heck of a he was a character, real character. He was from Massachusetts after the war. Well, he became very good friends with the Castell family there in a shop. Right on the corner of the main intersection. Those who may have watched the movie The Longest Day may have remembered seeing a paratrooper hung up on a church, which he did, which was a true story. And to this day, that paratrooper is up there in effigy, hung up on the church spire. But at the corner is E. Castell, which was a material shop with clothing. And Phil got to know that couple very well. Phil was of Norman descent as well, and he spoke fluent French, which is why they put him in that position. Well, after the war, he went back, ran for politics, was state assembly and state senate. And somewhere along the line, Antoinette's husband, Emil, passed away. And they had become friends. Phil had been going back there every 5 years or so just for reunions. And they were attracted to each other. They got married, and Phil stayed. Well, all of a sudden, the locals saying, there's an American from the war here living in our town. Well, villagers started bringing in stuff they had on their farms all these years, weapons, German and American weapons, uniform pieces, stuff, that they found on, because the whole area was a battlefield.
Sure.
So they brought it all there, and Phil never turned anything down. And so he built this building across the square, and he put all that stuff in there and moved forward a couple of years. One of the generals of one of the airborne divisions said, I can get you a glider. Could you use one of those for your museum? Phil never turned anything down.
So Did he have room for a glider?
He made room for a glider.
Okay.
So he has a glider, and when you go through the museum, you have to go through the glider to get to the other part of the museum.
Okay.
Okay.
I was like, how big is this building?
Okay. Well, and then the next year or 2 years later, the general from the other division, where'd you get that? He said, well, so-and-so from either the 82nd or 101st. I don't remember the sequence. Maybe if one of my guys in Europe are listening, they can let me know which division it was. They said, well, so-and-so, General so-and-so got it for me. He said, well, can you use a C-47? And Phil says, yes.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, Phil's going to have to go through some kind of a self-help program.
Well, so so they're in the town. The first time I visit the museum, the plane is in a building, a glass building with the roof looks like a parachute. It's white, looks like a parachute. Well, what happened is I'm looking at that thing, and I'm looking at the building, seeing all these original stone buildings from when the village was built in the 1700s or 1600s. I said, how'd you get this airplane in here? He said, well, they flew it to Cherbourg from England, dismantled it, helicoptered it in, and put it back together and put the building over it. So
wow.
That's how,
wow.
That's how creative he is. And he was just really creative. Well, unfortunately, he fell down the stairs and he passed away several years ago. And on a subsequent trip, one of your former co-workers, Aaron, Lisa Mara.
I was going to say, no pun intended, right?
I wanted to get to the cemetery to decorate his grave. It looked like it was chained, so Lisa said, no problem. She jumps over the fence into a cemetery in a little village in France and says, no problem. She opens up the gate, and we find his grave. That's not the lot you're going to hear about Lisa. But she's
got to watch her every minute.
Yeah, we decorated the grave. That was pretty neat.
Well, you know, something that speaking of the old buildings, when you really look at the number of battles and actually the wars that they fought over there in a lot of those countries, to me it's amazing that there are any old buildings left.
Yeah, that's true.
You travel around, you see these buildings that were built in the 1600s and, mm-hmm. and so forth, and they're still there.
Yes.
After all of this, and it just kind of makes me wonder, did they intentionally not destroy those buildings? I mean, how could they have survived the intensity of some of those battles?
Well, I know there's the bridge in Italy that I can't think of the name of it. It's real famous. It has all the shops on it that hang out over the river. And they made a deal during the war. Okay, the bridge is off limits. Nobody bombs the bridge. It was a deal that they made, because nobody could get anywhere if they bombed the bridge.
Right.
So I wonder if maybe there was a little of that, or they just got lucky.
Well, I don't know, but I have a friend in Venice who might be listening to this, and maybe he can send something in a chat room about this.
Yeah.
Well,
there's a lot of churches.
In Florence.
I know a lot of the churches were spared, and when you look at some of the churches over there, mm-hmm. The architecture, and I mean, these are churches built in the 1500s, 1600s.
Right.
And they're still there.
Well, there's one story about a church in a Belgian town. I was on a Kiwanis project, and my counterpart took us out to dinner. And when we went back outside, I noticed that all the buildings looked older, but the church looked brand new. So I asked him, I says, what was this place before it was a church? And he said that after that part of Belgium was liberated and our allies were across the Rhine River, a lot of our pilots, our bomber pilots and crews, had already had their 25 missions and had gone home. But what happened on this is they had new crews on this mission, and they were flying over, and they saw this river, and they thought they got to their target sooner than they expected. And so they released their bombs and dropped them on a town that had already been liberated and destroyed the church.
Oh.
Well, what happened is that they found about it when they got back to base. And a couple years after the war, those bomber crews came back and rebuilt the church.
No kidding.
Yeah. That's not the only place it's happened. I have another story about that as well, that in the village of Bella.
We were very gentlemanly back in the day.
Well,
you know, we kind of had, you know, rules. You know, really, everybody observed, sort of, like, we're at war, but let's not be nasty about it.
Well, you're right in that sense, Aaron, in that I also heard that Hitler apparently had an order that no battles were to be fought around cemeteries, Allied or German, because he had a great respect for the soldiers that were killed in battle. So he did not want any battles fought around cemeteries.
Wow. So military cemeteries. So if you're ever playing a board game and you need to come up with one nice thing about Hitler, you've got it.
That's it.
That's a toughie. That could be a winner there. Interesting, though. I mean, that doesn't hold today. You know, now we're fighting in a place where they strap bombs to children mm-hmm. and, you know, hide their armaments and their munitions in schools and hospitals so that those places get bombed. I mean, it's just...
Right.
It's very hard to wrap your mind around. Maybe war was simpler back then. And we fought to win.
That's right.
Which was another big distinction.
Well, the other thing I was going to bring up on St. Mary Glees, when we met to meet these people to deliver the flags, you don't just walk in and drop them off at City Hall. They have to have an official function.
Oh.
So the mayor,
it's a big deal.
The mayor's there, the ribbons, you know, and they wear the red, white, blue ribbon. The council members were there and stuff, and there was this one guy in line, a little short fellow, and I was asking everybody, you know, what they do if they were during the war, and this one gentleman, he's the shortest guy in the group, and his chest puffed out, and he says in French to Phil, he says, "I blew up three telephone poles." He was 12 years old. That was his job, to blow up three telephone poles and disrupt the German communication system.
And he was damn proud of it.
He was.
Yeah.
You saw that immediately.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
It's interesting because, you know, we've read about all these things, but obviously going there is 1,000,000% better, and especially since a lot of these people are still alive.
Yes, and to meet them.
Yeah.
And tell their stories. I mean, they're just, I'll tell you what, the Belgians and the Dutch, if everybody had their sense of humor and got along the way those two nations do, the world wouldn't have any problems. I mean, there's just, you know, you go to both countries and you don't know where you left one and gone into the other. Both great senses of humor. Yeah, you know, great people, fun-loving folks, etc.
And that's something you don't always hear, but you have to get out of the city.
Yeah.
Again.
Yeah. That's right.
It always ends with that, doesn't it? And you have to get out of the city. We need to take one last quick break here. I know before the top of the hour, I know your hour's, this 1 hour is almost up. Imagine that. You are listening to We the People Radio. Please join us online at some point, wethepeopleradio.us. We have a ton of information on there and some fabulous pictures.
Red roses too, I see them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
You're listening to We the People Radio on AM 1460 KCNR.
Welcome back. You are listening to We the People. We have some special sponsors today, and they're doing live commercials for you. Kind of fun. A little bit like old-time radio. But we're using the telephone, so I guess it's not that old-time. Our first person we have with us is Joseph Rice. He is with Oath Keepers. Hi, Joseph.
Good afternoon. How you doing?
Fire away. What do you have to tell us about Oath Keepers? Of Josephine County, I should say.
Yeah, Oath Keepers, we're a national group of former military and law enforcement, or current, and we support our constitutional oaths that we always uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States, and we will not violate the 10 amendments of the Constitution. We'll stand and protect those rights of all our citizens as a constitutional republic. We defend the individual right, which protects all of our rights. And that was recently demonstrated with the Sugar Pine Mine in Grants Pass, Oregon, where the Oath Keepers stood against the BLM, denying the miners their constitutional right to due process. And they were successful in forcing the BLM to go to a courtroom, and they're awaiting the decision so that miners have their day in court. But it's important to become involved in our community and protect those rights, as we've seen the erosion of them over the last decade or so.
That's
right. If anybody's interested, they could go to oathkeepers.com, find more about us nationally, and join your local chapter. We're in all 50 states.
Fabulous. Thank you. And we have a link to your website on ours. So the Josephine County, wonderful, Oregon Oath Keepers is on there linked.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. We'll hear from you next hour. Our next support personnel here is Mark Baird with the State of Jefferson. I guess we're all in the State of Jefferson, but you can speak for the State of Jefferson. How's that, Mark?
Thanks, Aaron. I appreciate that. I just want to tell a very quick story before I get to my point. I had a flight from Afghanistan, and as was so often the case, we had remains in the cargo compartment of the airplane. And each set of fallen soldiers' remains has a courier with it. And I remember we got to Air Force Base on the East Coast, and there were four or five guys that came up to the cargo deck, and they had a very small ceremony, and then they unloaded the remains of the fallen soldiers and took them to wherever they were going to go. And the courier that had been on top with one of these guys. He was with his buddy when he died, and he had bandages on his head, and his arm was in a sling. And he gets off the airplane, and he took his rifle bag and his rucksack, and he walks off down the ramp alone. No big parade, no crowd, no cheering throng, not even one single person to shake his hand, except the crew of the airplane. We did as he got off the airplane. But it just reminds me that liberty does have a price, and it's eternal vigilance. And I know that that gentleman can answer every second what he does to preserve liberty for his children and the rest of us. But can we all say the same thing? 2 o'clock on Tuesday, there is a board meeting in the Plymouth County Supervisor's office at 2 o'clock. And at that point, some outfit called Keep It California is going to give the Plymouth Board of Supervisors a presentation as to why they should do nothing instead of something in California. And I would just like to ask anyone that can, and if you can't, you can't, but if you can, be at that meeting and express to the supervisors how you think liberty is going in California and how you'd like to see them do something by supporting a Jefferson Declaration, which may at the very least restore representation in Northern California. It may or may not result in a new state. I hope it does. We don't know. But at the very least, the idea of representation will be discussed at the state level, and we could very well end up with more than we have now for rural counties. SOJ51.net, and thank you for having me on, and you have a great day today.
Thank you for your service, then and now. You're listening to We the People Radio here at KCNR 1460 AM. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Stay tuned for the second hour of We the People Radio. We have a lot more. Poor Mr. Delfino has books and papers, and we're going to put it all in the second hour. So if you're listening in Philly, join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
You're listening to KCNR Shasta Redding.